the title that you find in the lecture book is not the title that I first sent to Mike. The first title that I sent to Mike was Sex, God is for it, and so am I. But for some reason, Mike didn't feel like that was a title that he felt comfortable publishing. But I'm going to use it anyway as I get started today. I also told him I'm not at all sure why my lecture and Frank Hill's lecture are going on at the same time. It seemed to me that mine needed to follow his. Frank's going to talk about how to choose a mate, and I'm going to talk about how to keep your hands off that mate until you marry her. And I think there's good reason to have those follow one another. I hope that in the presentation that I'm privileged to make this morning, that I can help drive home the fact that sexual activity is not inherently sinful or harmful. Thank you, sir. But rather in its proper relationship, sexual activity is a beautiful act, a bonding act, and one that is sanctioned and designed by Almighty God. I know of mature saints who struggle in their marriage trying to fulfill their mate's sexual desire because they grew up with the concept that sex is dirty, that sex is grimy, and when you approach it with that kind of non-biblical attitude, having a healthy and fulfilling sex life in marriage is going to be difficult, if not altogether impossible. And so as we talk this morning about teenagers and sex, I want to try to help those in the audience this morning who are teenagers to understand why God's design is absolutely best, give those of you who are parents and grandparents perhaps some ammunition, some facts, and some approaches that you can use with your children so that it's not necessary to have the big talk, but that these principles of morality and godliness can simply be a part of how you parent and grandparent your child. The wise man wrote in the book of Proverbs, "Drink water from your own cistern, and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the street? Let them be yours alone, and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. His own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with cords of his sin. He will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray." It is by God's design that a husband and wife find sexual fulfillment with their God-sanctioned mate, and that to seek satisfaction outside of that relationship is a perversion, a dangerous and damaging perversion of the bond of marriage. And for those of you who are teenagers, perhaps still involved or preparing to be involved in the process of marriage, won't you notice, please, that the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord. You'll not find a dead-end street that is dark enough. You'll not find a dark enough corner of a nearby lake where you can engage in sexual sin and it be so dark that God cannot see you. You may fool your parents, but my dear friend, you will never fool God. Well, why would God limit sexual relationships to marriage? If we can be exhilarated by the physical love of a member of the opposite sex, if that can bring such pleasure and joy into an individual's life, why in the world would God limit that to marriage? And in limiting it to marriage, why would He limit it to only one partner? Why not allow us to have multiple partners? Why can't we be like Solomon and have our 300 wives? Well, I think it's important to understand that one of the reasons is because those kinds of relationships involve us in sin, and sin bars us from the kingdom of heaven. But in addition to that, we also need to understand that God is truly looking out for our best interest. God's definition and God's design of safe sex is not cruelly limiting, but is in fact liberating and does in fact bring us the greatest of joy. We've all probably heard the world banter about the idea of safe sex. And generally, when that term is used in the world, they mean a definition similar to what I found on the National Institutes of Health website. They say safe sex means taking precautions during sex that can keep you from getting a sexually transmitted disease or from giving an STD to your partner. They also generally include the idea that it involves not getting pregnant or not getting someone pregnant. That is a fundamentally flawed concept. The failure rate of condoms among teenage users in preventing pregnancies is an alarming 15 to 25%. We really don't know what the failure rate is in the spreading of HIV. But Margaret Feischel, in one study of married couples, found that if one partner was HIV positive and condoms were used consistently, that after 1.5 years of regular sexual activity, that 17% of the healthy partners became infected with HIV. Now, I'm not a mathematician. Brother Goodall, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention in your class. But I think if I did my math right, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1 in 6, or about the same odds of playing Russian roulette. How safe is that? In an analysis of 11 studies on condom effectiveness, researchers found that they failed in preventing the transmission of HIV about 31% of the time. Teresa Crenshaw, a past president of the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, asked a gathering of 500 sex and family therapists at a convention in Chicago, "How many of you recommend the use of condoms on a regular basis?" between unmarried partners. And nearly every hand in the auditorium went up. And then she asked, if your partner was HIV positive, would you feel safe and comfortable having a sexual relationship with them? And not a single hand was raised. The whole concept of the world's definition of safe sex is fatally flawed. This is not how I would define safe. If one out of six children who rode a school bus to school would be killed or dangerously harmed, how many parents would send their children to school on a school bus? If one out of every six airplanes crashed, how many of you would ever board an airplane? Amazing that this concept would never be applied to any other area of life. Yet, when the world tries to deny godly morals and God's plan, oftentimes reason is completely thrown aside. The world's definition of safe sex condones sexual activity as long as some type of protection is used. And in reality, safe sex, as the world defines it, depends on the strength of latex rather than the strength of moral absolutes and godly principles. But in contrast to that, let's look for a moment at God's plan for safe sex and how God defines it. God's definition of safe sex is very simple. It is abstinence before marriage and monogamy in marriage. During the 8 years that I taught sex education, 7th and 8th graders in the Clark County, Kentucky school system, I made an agreement with my wife that I would never discuss any area of our personal life in one of those classes. She happened to be teaching in one of the schools where I also taught. But what I did share with them was that I had zero fear of ever getting a sexually transmitted disease. That I had zero fear of being infected with HIV because of a monogamous relationship with a partner who shared that same commitment to monogamy. God's plan is 100% safe and 100% effective. Excuse me. It does call upon us to forego some momentary pleasure. Hebrews chapter 11 tells us that sin is in fact pleasurable for a season, for that short time. And so God tells unmarried couples to forego that momentary pleasure until they can place it in the right and proper context. The teenager, the young adult who follows God's plan has no concern about an unwanted or an unplanned pregnancy. If we had more time this morning, we could go into detail about how a young person's life is changed when they are the mother or father of an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy. In many cases, it carries with it baggage that couple carries for the rest of their life. There is absolutely no fear of sexually transmitted diseases. And again, if we had time, we could go into detail about all of the sexually transmitted diseases that are available today and that are out there on the market for young folks, folks who deny God's morals to catch. For our sake this morning, just let me say that if you get a sexually transmitted disease, you are going to itch, blister, or bruise, or itch, and ooze in places that you don't want to itch, blister, and ooze. Nothing pretty, comfortable, or funny about any of those diseases. The proverb writer says that he who keeps the commandment keeps his soul, but he who is careless of his ways will die. God knows what He's talking about and is truly looking out for our best interest. Well, not everybody who is sexually active outside of marriage is going to end up pregnant or with a sexually transmitted disease. So does that mean that those are the only consequences? Far from that. If you listen to God and follow God's morals, there is no pressure to marry before you're ready. Sexual relations by God's design create a bond between partners. When that sexual bond and the pleasure and exhilaration of a sexual experience is mistaken for genuine love, couples can marry, try to build that marriage on a faulty, flawed, and dangerously cracked foundation. But there's also an element of sexual relationships having a bonding effect that is incredibly serious. One of the things that I did with the middle school kids would be to come in with a roll of duct tape. And I'd look out for the biggest, toughest, hairiest armed boy in the class. And I'd bring him up in front of the class and rip off a piece of duct tape. And I'd say, sexual relations are designed to be just like this duct tape. And I would bond his arms together with that duct tape. And then I would rip it off as quickly as I could. I mean, they never failed. They'd holler, scream, go to their knees, weep, whine. That hurt, didn't it? Begin to build a relationship with someone based upon sexual relations. Mistake that for love. And when that is broken, it's painful. And then I would reattach the tape. Pull it off again. Put it on. Pull it off. Put it on. Pull it off. And after a couple of times, it didn't hurt anymore. Because the ability of that tape to bond had been seriously compromised. Young people who have multiple sexual partners before marriage make it more difficult to bond with the mate that they do marry because they have so mistreated themselves, their emotion, their soul, and their spirit, so that it's more difficult for the bond of a sexual union to indeed bond that couple together. There can be freedom from things like guilt and self-doubt, disappointment, worry, and a ruined reputation. Guilt is a consequence of premarital or extramarital sexual activity that may last longer than any of the other consequences. A young person might get sexually transmitted disease and with medical treatment get over it. They might have their reputation seriously compromised, move to a new community where they could begin building a reputation from a fresh start. But they carry the baggage of guilt everywhere they go. Casual sex without a deep, committed bond of love is damaging to an individual's self-image. Particularly among women, it can make them feel incredibly cheap and even filthy. There is no pill. There is no device. There is no condom that can protect our mind from guilt, a sense of self-accusation, or a ruined reputation. Recall that David, after his one-night stand with Bathsheba, in Psalm chapter 38, described himself while he was trying to cover up his sin as being both physically and emotionally sick. The young couple who follows God's pattern and makes a commitment to be abstinent until they are married will have the ability to communicate more and communicate more deeply with their date. It is a myth. It is a dangerous falsehood to suggest that a young couple can have sexual relationships and by that get to know the other person more deeply. That's simply nonsense. Premarital sexual activity often clouds the issue of what true love is. It tends to thwart the communication process. When a couple takes that off the table and they have a mutual commitment to godly morals as they date, they allow that relationship time and space to grow and mature, to truly get to know the beauty that resides within the other person. The proverb writer in chapter 6 and verse 32 writes, "The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find." We can have greater respect for ourselves when we choose godly morals. It's embarrassing. It's upsetting. It's emotionally damaging to wake up next to someone in the morning and realize that they are a total stranger. Not too awfully long ago, I was talking to a young man in his late 30s. He was raised in a home where his mother and father were both children of God and attempted to lead their children by the standard of God's Word. And he told me that he frequently had flashbacks to past sexual encounters. And he said that those flashbacks left him feeling grimy and uncomfortable even in the embrace of his lovely wife. How terribly tragic to make those few foolish choices and end up not liking yourself at all. We'll give you the opportunity to have greater trust in your mate in marriage. A young couple who can commit themselves to abstinence before marriage and be true to that commitment, prove to their partner that they have the ability to make a promise, to make a commitment, to take a vow and stick to it. Marriage to a person who has had multiple partners must always leave some lingering doubt in the other partner what they're doing when they're away. Momentarily, I want us to look at the temptation that Joseph faced in Genesis chapter 39. He was hated by his brothers, driven from his family, and sold into slavery in a foreign and godless land. He was sold into an immoral and religiously corrupt society. He's away from mom and dad. He's out of mom and dad's eyesight and supervision. He's away from home where nobody knows him. How easily Joseph could have made the wrong decision. Joseph was 17 years old when he encountered Mrs. Potiphar, a time when many young men are beginning to develop their strongest sexual impulses. The temptation that Joseph faced continually increased. It involved physical contact as Mrs. Potiphar grabbed him. Given that background, and given the intensity of the temptation, how in the world did Joseph make the right choice? First of all, he said no. He refused. He had a commitment to what was right and moral, and he refused to compromise. His answer to Mrs. Potiphar was not, "I'll think about it." His answer was not, "What's in it for me? Come back tomorrow and I'll think about it." His answer was a consistent no, because that was his commitment. He realized that people were counting on him. Potiphar trusted him. Potiphar trusted him with everything that he had, save his wife. He did not want to destroy or abuse the trust he had with Potiphar. Young folks, think about who may be trusting you. Your date's parents. What happens if you violate, break that trust? How do you ever rebuild that? You may have younger brothers and sisters that look up to you. You may have within your spiritual family people who respect you. Once that trust is broken, difficult to rebuild. Joseph realized that all sin was against his loving God. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? Joseph saw the moral and godly implications of those actions. Finally, he fled. He was willing to do what it took to get out of that situation. Joseph was not a coward. A coward would have betrayed his convictions and given in to the temptation. Rather, Joseph fled. He did exactly what Paul encouraged everyone to do in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 18, to flee immorality. Now, what Joseph did in refusing the temptation of Mrs. Potiphar is something that is within the grasp of each and every one of us. But also recognize that making the morally right choice doesn't always mean that we are going to be respected or that good things are going to come our way. Joseph ended up in prison. You may be made fun of if you make the morally right choice. Your date may not want to have anything to do with you anymore. They may break up with you. If that happens, please send them a thank you note for having taken actions that showed you what a truly, to the core, jerk they are. But also never lose sight of the fact that you will have the pleasure and the good will of your heavenly Father. And in His own time, He will reward you. Well, what about dating? Let me suggest some things to think about in regards to dating. Now, this may seem like a silly question. Why do you want to date? There's really nothing silly about that question. And it's a question that needs to be thought about before you find yourself in the back seat of Dad's old Ford at the end of a lonely, moonlit lane. To make certain that you and your partner know why you're out on a date. Don't wait till you're in the situation to make a decision to think about what you're wanting to get out of it. A lot of young folks, and used to say a lot of young men, but got to include young women in that more and more, are simply on the prowl for their next conquest, looking for something to brag about when they go back to school on Monday morning. As one young lady told me, she said, "My boyfriend is only interested in my body part and how generous I am willing to be with them." Important to know why you're dating and why your date wants to take you out. We're familiar with Colossians 3:17, that whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. Indeed, that date, that verse has an application to dating. Your personal pleasure and personal amusement must always be secondary to pleasing God, abiding within His Word. Consider the words of the wise old preacher in Ecclesiastes 11. "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood. And follow the impulses of your heart, the desires of your eyes. Enjoy your youth. Have a good time. Have fun." What a radical concept. "Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things." Another question that sometimes is asked, more so by parents and teens, is when is a good age to start dating? Well, there is no right age or magic age in which it suddenly a switch is flipped, and overnight that individual becomes capable where dating is appropriate for them. It's been suggested that when a person is mature and responsible enough to make godly dating rules, when they have proven the ability to make godly decisions under pressure, then they're ready to start dating. But also recognize that the earlier, particularly the earlier girls, start to date, the greater the likelihood that they will be sexually active before they're married. Well, who are you going to date? 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, "Don't be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals." 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14, "We are not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers." These and other passages ought to impress upon young people and parents the importance of making careful, cautious decisions about both friends and who they will date. While I was teaching this course in middle school, I asked one class to come up with a set of rules that would help you make wise choices who to date. This came out of a class where not a single member of the class was a Christian or who had parents who were New Testament Christians. And this is what the young folks came up with. Avoid people who use bad language. That tells you something about their heart and character. Avoid people who have bad reputations. They very likely deserve those. Avoid those who use drugs or alcohol, when their self-control may very well be compromised. Look below the surface. Go beyond looks and popularity. I found that really interesting, particularly considering it came from a class of seventh graders, none of whom had been raised by genuine Christians. Choose someone who shares your core values and standards. It will be much easier to make the right decision if the person you're dating has the same commitment that you do. If you're having trouble finding someone of this nature to date, go fishing. Visit other congregations. See what's available. Parents, take your children to visit other congregations to see what young people there might be available. We've got a couple of young girls at Lafayette Heights that I think can make some young man a really good wife. They're both incredibly good looking. They would be horribly embarrassed if they knew I was saying this, but I will not mention their name. But if you've got a young man in his early 20s looking for a good-looking, head-turning woman who's got a good head on her shoulder, send him up, and I'll make the introduction. Well, where are you going to go on a date? I think it's important to make certain that you make plans and engage in activities where you can stay busy. The old chimney corner scripture that idle hands are the devil's workshop. When choosing where you're going to go and what you're going to do on a day, choose activities that don't present the possibility of lighting a fire that may be difficult or impossible to put out. The easiest fire to extinguish, the one that never gets lit. The same group of young people that I asked to set up a set of rules as regarding who you would date, I asked the question of where should you go and do on a date. They said plan dates that will encourage you to talk so that you really get to know the other person. Do things and go places where you don't have to come home and lie to your parents about what you did and where you were at. Avoid being alone for long periods of time. Certainly avoid the dark. We had a rule at our house that under no circumstances could our son or daughter have a member of the opposite sex in our home unless Diane or I, one, were present. And that they were not allowed to go to someone else's home and be in a house with the member of the opposite sex if their parents were not home. On more than one occasion, I would come home and find my children swinging on the porch swing with their date, the front door still locked. And I so appreciate them doing that. Avoid places where drugs or alcohol are being used. They lower your inhibition. We've all heard the stories of some drunk at a New Year's Eve party putting the lampshade on their head and dancing on the table. I've never seen a sober person who would do something like that. Dates can become much more grabby when alcohol or drugs are involved. Plan group dates. Well, how much physical contact? I think that depends
a lot on the character and the age of those that are involved. Remember the principle of flee fornication. And ladies, please remember, and parents, communicate to your daughter that males are more visually and physically oriented than females, and they get turned on and aroused much more quickly, much more easily, and much more intently than young ladies typically are. I heard of some wise advice that a godly father gave to a very dear friend of mine when that father and gospel preacher sat down to have the big talk with his son. This is a bit crude and pointed, but I hope you will endure it to understand the point behind it. What this father told his sons and his daughter was that a stiff penis has no conscience. That when a young man is sexually aroused, he typically stops thinking with his brain and thinks with his crotch. And that's a dangerous situation. Ladies, remember that your date may be hot and bothered while you're as cool and in control as could be. And you're wondering why he can't keep his hands off of you. And he's just groping and exploring with his hands. What may you have been involved in that helped to light that fire? When you're considering how much physical contact is appropriate on a date, think about the consequences of that. How far would you go if Christ was in the room? How far would you go if your parents were in the room? I often ask kids, what would you do on a date if you were in the back seat with that girl who looks good and smells good and you adore? If her mom and dad were sitting in the front seat of the car, you simply don't do anything that you would be embarrassed for other people seeing you do or that you might regret. And here is, I suppose, the golden rule of dating. If you're asleep, wake up. If you're taking notes, write this down. If you're highlighting things in the book, highlight this. If you remember nothing else, remember this and take it home with you. The golden rule of dating is simply don't let any part of anyone else's body come between you and your clothes. And odds are, you'll be able to be successful. What if I mess up? There may be some here this morning who have already messed up. And you know what it's like to have violated God's law and have to live with the consequences. Confess your sin and don't try to hide it. With the realization, the blood of Christ will cleanse us from every confessed and repented sin. While you recognize that God will forgive you, be ready to reap what you have sown. While God will forgive, doesn't always take the consequences away. Well, what if a pregnancy is involved? Abortion and abandonment for a child of God are neither viable choices. If a pregnancy is involved, should you marry or not marry? One mistake doesn't necessitate making another mistake. One moment of passion doesn't mean that you are ready or should make a lifetime commitment. Because you have made a mistake and a pregnancy may have resulted from it, doesn't necessarily mean the wisest thing is to get married. As you think about what you need to do, if indeed you mess up, as you reap what you have sown, also deal with your feelings, deal with the guilt, and forgive yourself. Read Psalm 51. And underline, highlight, mark, and imprint on your mind David's attitude when he recognized that God indeed had forgiven him. And then be ready to move on with your life. There's some information in the book about talking with your children about sex. And I think one of the most important things to do as you talk to your children about these things, is talk about them continually. Talk about them in ordinary situations. Don't just wait until you sit down and have that big talk. The earlier you start, would you take the initiative to instigate the conversation? Talk about morals and values. Provide information that is appropriate to their age and give them the right information. Communicate your values, your morals. I think it's really important for daddies to talk with daughters and mamas to talk with sons. Daddy, love your little girl. Love your little girl. Make them feel pretty. Make them feel appreciated. Help them to have a positive concept of their personal worth. And you'll go a long way toward helping them make right moral choices. You really do know more than your children do. But when you sit down to talk with them, be prepared for them to have a bit of a negative reaction. They're probably more uncomfortable with that than you are. Talk with your children. Regrets can last a lifetime. I've talked with more people than I care to think of who were sexually active before marriage and lived to deeply regret what they have done. But I have never talked with a person who made the decision to wait until marriage to become sexually active, who regretted that decision. We need to impress upon the minds of our young people God's plan for our salvation, an understanding of His grace and His willingness to forgive us when we respond to Him according to His will. The proverb writer asks, "Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned?" And we understand the answer to that. Above all, flee immorality. I have attempted this morning to cover what I would typically cover in about 8 hours. Have left out stuff that I hated to leave out and have had to talk faster than I wanted to talk. But I hope these things have been helpful to you both as young people and as that indeed we might flee fornication, stand right before our God.